I am joined today by Corey Clamp, who is a former visa officer, although we'll get into your specific titles. It's a lot more varied than just visa officer, as well as now you are you studying to be a consultant or you've become one?
No, I'm studying to be a consultant. I entered in the fall 23 cohort and I should be graduating this summer.
Nice, congrats.
Thank you.
Let's dive in to your roles. You reached out to me after I had posted about which tweet was it? Was it about the amount of time visa officers spend on applications?
Yeah, it was the processing expectations for different offices that had been released, and you had just kind of asked if there was any feedback from other officers, what they thought about it. So I chimed in.
Yeah, and it was and from there I thought it'd be great to have you on the podcast. Now you were a visa officer some time ago, so things
Yes.
and this was part of what you had emailed me about was that things may have become since a bit more condensed and time sensitive in terms of what officers do. Are you still in touch with a lot of people from CIC,
Not a
IRCC?
lot. No, not a lot. I've got a few good friends, and those relationships are really on the friend level. But no, I don't. I haven't kept in touch with a lot. Every few years there'll be a reach out and touch base, but that's about it.
How did you get the job?
I was doing my law degree. I was in year two at University of New Brunswick. I had done a poli sci degree previously at Dal and Dalhousie University in Halifax, and actually, it was a fellow classmate who had started the process of applying for the Foreign Service, and we were talking about it, and I thought, well, I'll throw my hat in the ring. And it's a quite a long recruitment process, but I was offered the position. I can't remember if I was had completed year three or if I had graduated, but was offered the position in mid-2002.
Is that the track for visa officers, or is the Foreign Service? I would have thought that that was like Department of Foreign Affairs, Global Affairs. Is that also where at the time maybe IRCC recruited, then
So
CIC?
the I believe it's still the same. So there had been a hiring freeze for some time with the Foreign Service, and when I was applying, it had been, I think it was the first new hiring process that they had undertaken after a while. And so at the time, and I believe it's still the case, for officers who are going to be working overseas, Global Affairs or DFAT back in the day, and CIC both did the same recruitment. And what would happen,
Okay.
there was three streams. You had the migration stream, immigration stream, the trade stream, and the political economic stream.
Do you pick at
And
the outset which one you want to do?
you indicate what your preferences are, and
Interesting.
then at the end of the process, you get a phone call, and it might be CIC that calls, it might be the political branch of DFAT, or it might have been the trade stream that called you up. And so it was CIC that called me. And my original intent was to go for political economic, but as I learned more about it and saw that a CIC agent would be overseas for about two-thirds of their career, I thought, wow, that was right up my
Yeah,
alley at the time.
that's
And
probably
so
shifted. Well, maybe not if it was through the foreign. Do you know if that's how, is it still recruited? Like, are visa officers recruited for domestic branch, which is huge compared to the people overseas now, or is it
completely different process.
completely
So right
different?
now, if you were to work overseas as a visa officer, you would still, and so I was just like looking this up the other day in preparation for this, but so once hired, you enter into the Foreign Service Development Program. We were one of the first groups going into that. It's a 3-year training process that all visa officers and well, Foreign Service officers undertake. It'll look different, obviously, depending on the stream you're in. But yeah, that's still the process now. So if you're going overseas, that is you're an FS classification. Whereas if you're in Canada as an immigration officer, and I don't know the details around the recruitment process there, but someone who is like, let's say, a senior immigration officer in Canada, that would be like a PM4 classification. Whereas, once you complete the FSDP, you graduate into the FS2 classification, which is the equivalent of around, like, I think it's a PM6 or PM7
Yeah. For those who don't
in
know, these are
Canada.
all government acronyms that correspond, I guess, to pay grades, transferability to an extent between departments. My wife works for government, so I'm familiar with the whole letter. She's in the EC category, which I can't
Yeah, so
remember
like
what
for
that even stands for.
VCs, so an FS2 would be equivalent to an EC6,
Oh, okay.
which, yeah, if that means anything for
Yeah,
people.
no, I know, like, yeah, it's so different from the private sector, like the big, there's the acronym classifications and the mobility between and the different pay grades and everything. It's a very different
Well, it's a
stepping,
union
watching from the
environment.
outside, looking in, it's bureaucratic. I'll say that.
One thing I had to say, I mean, it is bureaucratic, but and you know, hindsight 20 is always 2020. I didn't appreciate how well run things were at the time. All I felt was the bureaucracy and the
Yeah.
slow speed of things, which as a young person just coming out of school, felt problematic to me, much more so than it should have. Given the incredible range of audiences that CIC in this case is trying to, I'm going to say, appeal to, depending on what the audience is, they have different aims and goals. Like, without that kind of bureaucracy, without that level of detail to roles and responsibilities,
Yeah.
I don't think they could do the work as well as they had done then. As and I'm not saying this as a, you know, as a trying to be friendly, but you know, as well as they're doing now, I know there's a million things that are problematic, and I talk about them from time to time, but it's an incredibly challenging
Oh
environment
yeah,
to
I mean, and I
operate
see
within.
through the A tips. I don't normally tweet or share the HR related A tips that land on my desk, but the scale of IRCC, like I think as lawyers or consultants, we see a very narrow part of what goes on from settlement to passports to, I mean, it's an organization of thousands and thousands of people dealing with all sorts of mandates. But so let's go to your first role, which was surprising to me that this would be a first role, which was litigation management analyst. So I guess kind of naively, I had thought but that's something that you would need several years of experience before you're being a litigation management analyst. Can you describe the role a little bit? I get the A tips from some of the people who currently work there, but you know, it would be helpful to provide just what does the litigation management branch do?
Well, so that's a big question. I was working beneath an actual. There was a lawyer that I was working beneath. Martin Mundell was his name. My primary responsibility at that time was to aid in the drafting of the annual litigation case review, which is essentially just going over as much of the case law as possible that had come out
Yeah.
in the previous year,
It's a good
providing
role for
brief.
someone who'd finished law school.
Oh, it was fantastic, right up my alley.
Yeah.
And so my responsibility in that position was really to put that together, with the guidance of Martin. And but the team as a whole were there. Their primary responsibility was to ensure that the work of Department of Justice, when it came to representing, because at the time that were those were the ones responsible who were representing us in court. That their approach to whatever cases were being heard aligned with CIC policies. And so I was not part of those conversations, but Martin and other more senior individuals were always working with, whether it be senior management within CIC or with the lawyers from DOJ to ensure that, you know, the steps being taken aligned. With what the priorities were for the department.
Did you, and this is something that I think a lot of lawyers wonder, is when it comes to, say, settling litigation, who makes the call? Is it the litigation management branch, DOJ?
That was above my pay grade. I wouldn't be able to speak to that. But so to go back to your earlier comment though about this seeming like a kind of a high level role for someone in their first position, like this isn't coming out as a brag or anything along those lines, but I was so blown away by the caliber of the people I was working with, that were part of the my cohort that were recruited. It's they're, PhDs from different fields. I mean, I came from a very traditional background of political science law. That was not the bulk of people who I'd been recruited with. And my impression was that the work being done by FS officers within CIC
I'm sorry, what's
was a
FS?
foreign service officers
Okay.
within and CIC is IRCC nowadays, but the work being done by the FS officers in the international region was a very different beast than what you would consider what would be a normal career path or the work being done by immigration officers who are domestically based. It's they're two very different positions,
In
and
what
I'm
way?
oh and I mean a variety of ways. So the education background, the requirements to even apply for the position, it's a huge difference. Like, I don't know enough about how the work is done in Canada, and I think there's a really interesting conversation or analysis to be done there, because I was looking at a posting today for a senior immigration officer in Canada with supervisory responsibilities. That's a PM4 position. And the Whereas if you were to apply for the Foreign Service Development Program now, like I said, that's equivalent right now, I think, with like a PM6, I want to say, with if you graduate to the FS2 position, it's a little bit higher. But my point is simply that the work, if my understanding of how the work is done in Canada is correct, and that you have a Canadian individual sitting there with a file in front of them, reviewing the application and making a decision, yes, no, need more information, interview, which is essentially the work that we did overseas. I'm just curious what the justification would be within the department to have such different levels of requirements for entry into those roles.
I mean, from what I can tell is that right now the more complicated files go overseas. And I think there's some discussion. Like, do you think that as more and more files move to the domestic network and the domestic network is the fastest growing, subset of IRCC, do you think it's important that there is still a large overseas international network?
I don't think you could do this job properly just within Canada.
Because of
I
the need to
think.
interview people or for local, the experience that people will have abroad, familiarity with documents, risk analysis, calling people in overseas countries to verify employment.
You're hitting all sorts of nails on the head. I mean, just so. I mean, the reality is, in a lot of the countries that we operate within, it's a the ability to hire locally engaged staff, it costs a lot less than if you were to hire people to do equivalent work in Canada. That's
Yeah.
just a fact. When I was working in New Delhi, I had two program assistants that were my program assistants to help me with my caseload. There was, and as well, there was a whole other like army of staff to help us from everything from application intake. This was pre visa application centers, everything from application intake to there was a whole registry for the storage of files, the movement of files. We had, like as you mentioned earlier, we had a crew that was dedicated to the reviewing of documents, or if there was issue, if we started seeing trends in terms of like applications from this particular area or applications for individuals destined to this particular school or place of employment seemed to be having problems. There was concerns around fraud with certain documentation. We'd be able to send all
Yeah.
the applications coming into this particular unit. In Canada, for whatever reason, my impression is that they don't have the same resources for staff. So right there, you're running into issues. You don't have the same amount of muscle to process through the mountains of applications that are coming in.
How much turnover is there overseas? So like I mentioned, my wife works for government, and the amount of, she'll go on a mat leave, and when it's time to go back, there'll be like almost 100% turnover, it seems, in the
With respect to
people, lateral moving, promotions, new people joining, people taking opportunities elsewhere within government.
so
I
within
mean,
the
even
FF,
looking at your history, like, you look like you are on the move almost annually.
you had so this is the way so the way it works for a visa officer, depending on the country, you're going to be in country anywhere from 2 to 4 years. So each mission has a hardship designation. So there's no hardship designation for, let's anywhere in Western Europe you're going to go there. That's probably going to be a 4 year posting. Whereas if you were heading to Dhaka or New Delhi, I'm not sure what the hardship is for New Delhi nowadays, but it goes up to a five. Five would be, Afghanistan, Kabul, something like that. Delhi was a four when I was there. And those tend to be 2 year postings with the option of a third year. Typically, you will go into mission. This was again back in 20 years ago now. You'd go into mission. You would serve a role for 1 year, possibly 2 years. When I was in Delhi was my first full posting. So as part of the FSTP, they want to ensure you have full exposure. So you get slotted into the temporary resident unit. From there, depending on your skill sets and interests, they'll find different hats for you to wear, put you into the next, like into the PR unit after that. And then after your second or third year, you're on to your next posting. So I went from Delhi to Vietnam in this particular instance.
Yeah. So, and then in Delhi,
So
you were a temporary resident unit operations supervisor.
that's right. So, go ahead.
Oh no, I was just I
Oh.
mean, I was like, you're, so I was just going to say with that read, like, that's overseeing, as it sounds, temporary resident processing.
Yeah, so that was really the operation side of things. But just to go back really quickly towards your questions, I didn't see any real turnover. I was the first person, like there was a lot of shock and surprise when I actually did leave the department. And the
Oh no, I didn't mean leaving the
majority.
department, but like if you're saying that there's, you go to India, which is a 2 year posting with the opportunity of three, wouldn't that mean, like, except for locally engaged staff, there's complete turnover at the office there every 2 to 3 years?
That's right.
Yeah.
And so you'd have, and so now obviously the immigration program manager, that's someone who's there in that role for the entire duration of their tour. The same thing for the deputy program manager. And there's other kind of more senior positions where that person would be in that role for the duration, the migration integrity officer. But for the general processing people, yeah, that would be changing on a
Yeah.
very regular basis.
Now, one thing I've noticed in taking India in particular is that approval rates, were call them at 80%. Then there's a 3 year period where they drop dramatically to like 50%. Now they're back up to where they were. Is that, like, in your opinion, knowing that you're not, working there now, some people would speculate that that's a function of that advanced analytics software that's being used and a change in the rules. I'm wondering, from what you're saying, is could that also just be a reflection of the people coming in and out during that 2 to 3 year period? Like, to what extent do you think the individual people play a role in overall approval rates?
I think they play a big role.
Yeah.
I think they play. I mean, I was listening to your episode. There was one of the episodes that you had done about working from CIC to becoming a consultant. I can't remember
Oh, that's an
the
old,
name
that's
of the.
Danny Willetts.
Yeah, it was like episode six, I think it was. And and there was a whole conversation about feathering of discretion and different things. And I. The reality is, I do believe the officer plays a huge role. Now, obviously, you have management people who are watching, approval, refusal rates, and working with officers to make sure that everyone's kind of in the same ballpark. But again, depending from the IPM down, depending on
IPM is
which way
Immigration
the
Program Manager.
yeah,
Yeah.
sorry, depending on which direction the pressure's pushing, I can certainly imagine that for lack of a better word, I'm gonna say personalities could have a huge influence on approval and refusal rates. Now, having said that, there can be big trends that have huge impacts on approval or refusal rates too. If all of a sudden an agent an in-country agent comes across a means of making some money off of some naive applicants, and our office for a period of a month or two is inundated with just fraudulent study
Yeah.
permit applications. This is not a comment on the applicant, but rather on the agent who was working. If we're flooded with all of us in literally hundreds, if not thousands, I mean, but of applications that are just photocopy of photocopy of photocopy. You can line them up and they're identical applications with the names being different. I mean, that's going to have an impact on your on the approval or
Yeah.
refusal rates, right? And so, and that's not something that the mission is necessarily going to publicize, or at least at the time, that was certainly not an approach that they took.
No, definitely. And so you go from temporary residence, where one of the things you did was reviewing high-profile religious worker applications and developing culturally sensitive processing guidelines. How hard is that to go from place to place, encountering completely new cultures and figuring out how to process them within basically a Western framework? And then I think you're talking like the role of religious workers, arranged marriages in the permanent residence context. Actually, what are some of the cultural challenges with religious workers in Delhi?
So, well, I mean, just very briefly, it's not if you're coming from a Gurdwara and you've got, and I should have refreshed my memory on the names for the different roles, but if you've got individuals coming from a Gurdwara or a Hindu temple, these are not individuals who are going to necessarily be particularly affluent. They are
Yeah.
not going to meet the typical definition. They're not going to meet the typical requirements that we would be looking for if we were going to issue just a straight up TRV. So having said that, and if they're coming from a Gurdwara in India to one in Canada, and the homework hasn't been done, and the application is just presented as someone on the side of their desk put it together and submitted it, that could be a very easy refusal. And often that's what would happen. These applications would come across a visa officer's desk. They're not necessarily they haven't educated themselves on what this means, what is happening in this
Yeah.
particular application. They see someone intending to travel to Canada. There may or may not be a letter of invitation. And when you've got a giant pile of applications waiting for processing there, if it's a straightforward, easy refusal, that's what happens. And then afterwards, you start getting MP representations. Hey, this Gurdwara in my riding was trying to invite these well-known singers to come participate in at events in the space. What's going on? Why were they
Yeah.
refused? Well, it entails a whole bunch more work. So it really, with respect to religious workers, the big thing was, and so kind of going to the point of creating culturally sensitive documents, it was really just creating resources for Canadian officers to make use of so that when these came across their desks, they would know, all right, this particular Gurdwara in Mississauga has a strong history of inviting people from the Punjab to take part. This has been the result of those past experiences. This is what the profile typically looks like for someone who's coming over. These are the things you should be looking for. When it comes to interviewing, ensuring that there is a regularly rotating list of questions that can be asked, so that people can demonstrate that they are experienced in the work that they do. Just because someone says they're a preacher doesn't necessarily mean that they are. I'm using the word preacher generally, that's not the right word, but you want to make sure that they have an understanding of the religion that they're working within. And you want to be able to ask those questions in a way that is sensitive to the person across the desk from you. You don't want to be coming at them and asking them nonsense questions that they shouldn't be expected to answer. And so a lot of the work that was required to get those tools together was, going out into community, finding reputable individuals whom you could speak with and get information from. And because at the end of the day, we're dealing with people all the time, and I can't quiz. This was a little bit, there was internet, but it wasn't quite the way it is now. You had to, I'm not going to be able to quiz the book and ask questions and get kind of drilled deeper than if I'm actually going to a temple and speaking to someone who's looking to work with us and kind of make those ties between the Canadian institutions and the Indian institutions a little tighter.
Just skipping forward a bit, you go from
Sure.
India to Vietnam. What's that like? The different, like, would you say that? I often say that each port of entry, each CBSA office almost has its distinct personality. Is it when you go from India to Vietnam, is it the same thing? Like there's a whole new culture here in terms of how off applications are processed. Is it similar?
So it was a huge difference, everything from the size of the mission to how we processed applications. The biggest change for me was the shift in mission size. Whereas in Delhi, there was very much a hierarchy. In Vietnam, we operated out of a consulate in Ho Chi Minh City. The embassy was actually in Hanoi. All the PR work was done out of, I believe it was Singapore at the time. So we were strictly dealing with
Yeah, I
temporary
think it's still
residents.
similar.
So it was it, the biggest change was in the size of the mission and the volume of applications.
Do you still have the same ratio of applications to officer in both? Like there's less officers, but less applications? Or is it so much smaller that you're dealing with more applications per officer?
Oh, you're dealing with less applications
Oh, less
per
applicants.
off. Oh, way less. Yeah,
Yeah.
there was two of us. There was myself, and there was
Two.
the immigration. Yeah, there was myself and the immigration program manager. That was it at the time. Yeah. One of the questions from that episode six, and I can't remember exactly what the question, how the question had been posed, but was like, one of the things that they were looking for when hiring for the immigration stream of the FS was the ability for like adaptability. And they were looking, they don't want someone, they don't need experts, because experts know a lot about, a narrow range. They really seem to look for someone who's more, I'm going to say, generalist, someone who's able to take in information and I don't want to say analyze, like just take it in and process it, and then and start working. And yes, you need some depth, But it's really the ability to kind of go in there and synthesize information materials and start working with it, much in the same way I think as a lawyer does, really. I mean, lawyers, there's not every lawyer. Like if you're a general practice lawyer, my understanding is you're dealing with everything from real estate to criminal to
Yeah,
some
I don't know how they
family and
do
all.
it. I don't know how they do it.
Well,
When I
so
started
that's
immigration, I thought I would do immigration, tax, and estates, which
I
people who are lawyers are, I think anyone would now laugh and be, what were you thinking? When you were there, so there's another consultant who mentored me a fair bit when I was starting, who also used to work for the department, who talked about how, and I don't know if there's overlap with when you were at the department, that the department was struggling because there was someone processing visas who pretty much had a no one is illegal mentality and was just very adverse to refusing applications. Did you meet people who were similar? Like, what was the general attitude to refusing? Like, was it hard? Did it get easier as you went
No.
along?
For me, well, I often found it hard to like, so, nowadays I'm definitely more of the no one is illegal camp than I've ever been before.
Were you the
at the,
officer who was not not just kidding.
no. So I think amongst the, so I think if you were to look for a divide, and not that that's what you're looking for, but amongst the FS, I think it really was, we're looking to see if the person meets the requirements for issuance, period. Yes, there would be times where it was hard to say no, but there were mechanisms that you could use to, if you really felt it warranted a yes, there were mechanisms you could use, whether it's a TRP or agency or whatever else. Saying yes, I found problematic in a lot of, like the living caregiver program at the time. We had young women. So going back to India for a second, we would have young women coming out of villages in the Punjab who had taken, I can't remember how long the program had to, the course had to be, but a relatively short course on learning how to be a living caregiver, which was essentially a course on how to pass a living caregiver interview. And if they had their grade 12 and they had their course and they had sufficient English and the job offer, and I think the NLMIA was required at the time, we had to say yes. We didn't
Yeah, that's a
have,
tough one.
oh, and so, and I mean that whole piece was one big reason why I ended up leaving the de department. Myself and a colleague had approached, we were both still in the FSDP at the time, the Foreign Service Development Program, and we, had approached more senior individuals, asking if there was the possibility of creating a multi-language pamphlet that could be inserted in the passport, that would have a list of resources and, a breakdown of their rights when they're in Canada. And I mean, it wasn't said as bluntly as this, but essentially we were told that's not our prerogative, that is the responsibility of the province and others. No, we can't do that.
Yeah, I hadn't thought
And
really that the yeses would be as hard. Have you ever read there's a I don't even know what her title would be, an activist in the United States named Ayaan Hirsi Ali, who was in her book she talks about how she was basically on a flight to Canada having gone through a forced marriage, and she essentially ran off the plane, I think in the Netherlands. And I wonder, like, as as a visa officer, would it ever get back to someone that someone they approved was a victim of trafficking or?
not, I did not experience that. And I think for the most part, visa officers don't. We would occasionally, like I think in my entire time there, I might have two or three times gotten feedback that one of my applications that I had said yes to turned in, like for on a TR side, that one of the approvals I would have put out there turned, it resulted in someone making a claim, like a
Like
refugee
a
claim.
refugee claim, yeah.
But beyond that, you once that visa was issued, it was gone. Like you never knew the end of that story.
When people learned that you were a visa officer, What was the reaction?
Everyone wants to be your friend.
Exactly.
Everyone
Actually,
wants
I
to be
was
your friend.
at I have kind of one more question on this topic before we get to a general listener topic. But this question, I think we'll have a lot of different, approaches to answer, which was when I was in Shanghai about a decade ago, I was having dinner with someone who had hosted a party, and he had unsuccessfully tried to get a visa for his girlfriend to visit his parents in Canada, and it was refused. And he was telling me that at this party, there was a visa officer there, and the guy kind of made what sounded like a bit of a show of asking the person to leave, having been from the entity that denied his girlfriend the ability to visit. I can't remember why it was refused.
Sure.
Do you think that that is fair? Or what, like, obviously, for individuals, these are huge personal decisions. I guess if you were in that position, what would you want that person to know or to consider?
What would I want the person who had experienced the negative,
And
who
now
had had
hates
that?
visa, and now I guess hates visa officers. Right? Like, and I
What
think a
would
lot of
I?
people do really personalize it, right? Like, when they get refused, they get really angry, not necessarily at the system or the law, but at the individual officer.
I think that what would I want them to know? We are limited. We are limited as to the leeway we have when we approach a file. There's a limited amount of time. There is a limited amount of information that we have access to about the background of the people. And as straightforward as something might seem to an individual, I want to go to Canada to attend my cousin's wedding because it's a great chance to see a country I've never visited before. The visa officer doesn't know that that's your cousin. If you didn't tell us, we definitely don't know. We don't know that when you write down any good hotel as the place you're staying, that you've put that down because booking a hotel is no big deal for you and taking a trip internationally isn't stressing you out because you're a low-key individual and can handle that. So if at the end of the day, we're not making a decision based on the person, we're making a decision based on the application, and it isn't personal. Where, for the most part, visa officers overseas aren't making judgment calls on the morality or the goodness or badness of the person that's being represented by this piece of paper or computer screen, I guess nowadays, that they're looking at. They're making a decision that's based on, the few short bits of the few words that they read and what the policy and legislation dictates. And it's as simple as that. We are a tool.
I know I had said before we started recording that there was a listener question that I wanted to ask, but I'm going to switch that because I got another question today actually from a journalist in response to something I had tweeted, and I think you'd be a really interesting person to answer it. So I'm going to ask a question without any warning, which have been most of the questions. But
Yeah,
so
that's fine.
the context was during COVID, there was a backlog of visa applications that grew. And in 2023, the department enacted a public policy to essentially waive IRPR 179 requirements, which is the requirements that visa applicants show that they'll leave Canada by the end of their authorized stay, and essentially bulk approved visitor visa applications without. As long as people were not criminally or medically inadmissible, they even waived financial inadmissibility. And so
Wow.
I had tweeted yesterday that there was a memo to the minister which said that as of December 2023, about 19,600, I can't remember if that's the, I mean, that's a pretty precise figure, but it's close to 20,000. Of people who had arrived under that public policy had claimed refugee status, and it's now closed. So And the journalist was asking what my thoughts were on the program. And I'm curious, as a former visa officer, what your thoughts are on a decision to bulk approve applications. Both, I guess, your thoughts as a visa officer, but now you've said you've shifted more to a no one is illegal mentality. But do you still think an approach that says we're bulk approving? Just what are your thoughts on the decision to do that? If you were still a visa officer, would you have been sitting there going, "Are you serious?" Like, what are your thoughts on it?
I think people, for the most part, are the same across the world. We want good food, we want good drink, we want our families to be healthy and happy. I think from a visa officer, like, processing perspective, I think that as long as the processes we had to follow were well developed, and that, issues around, like, I'm sure there was still a certain amount of, like, basic security screening that had taken place. Like, certain profiles would get
Yeah, they
shifted
still
to a
did
different team.
security screening. They just weren't
So,
looking at whether someone would leave Canada.
I don't view it as a negative. I don't view it as a bad thing. When I was in Delhi, the Minister Volpe at the time made a sudden announcement that they were going to triple the processing, the issuance of visas for FC4 for parents and grandparents, for PR applications. So from 6,000 a year to 18,000 a year for, I can't remember, it was 2004 and 5 or 5 and 6. I think it was 5 and 6. And so, like, that decision was made. He made the announcement, and that's how we in Delhi learned about it, which who had one of the biggest inventories of FC4 applications to go. So you shifted gears. You developed a process to ramp up your processing, the way you're going to
Yeah.
process these things, and make sure that they're being done properly. Guaranteed, every family that got to have their parent or grandparent come join them in Canada was immensely thankful for that to happen. I say every family, the most of them
Yeah.
were immensely happy to have that happen. The grandchildren who were able to have that caretaker there with them, the parents who didn't have to now shell out for childcare, that was a huge benefit for those families, the communities they lived in, the employers who now get to have a more relaxed
Yeah.
employee. Like, we act like these immigration programs, that these targeted immigration programs that we have all over are gonna fix these single problems. The housing crisis is going to be resolved by bringing in more tradespeople. Or if we if we want to grow the population, let's grow the population. But I think that it's, at the end of the day, people are, every person is an individual. The actions they take within Canada could be good, could be bad, could be somewhere in between. And the fact that 20,000 people from that public policy may have become refugee claimants, that's part of their story. They're going to
Yeah.
continue being in Canada afterwards. And the data shows that, claimants over their lifetime are not drains on the system, that they are, there's a net zero. Like, it's not a negative or a positive necessarily, if you're looking at it in terms of, like, the economic sense. They
We'll see
come in
what the
here.
I mean, it's still too it's very early to see what the approval rate will be of the claims. But
Fair enough. That's a good
I see
point
your
you're
point.
making.
Like, I think you're making a good, I think a lot of the coverage of this has been sort of on the, was this the right approach to clear the backlog?
What's the other option? You're going to cancel
To
all their
cancel them.
application.
Oh yeah, cancel and refund the $100.
I mean, Harper wasn't had no problem doing that for all those skilled worker applications. I mean,
It's a
I
different
don't.
approach. It's I'm not sure where I fall. I mean, I totally take your point on the human component, right? Like, and I do believe that as you like are targeted programs that you talk about? Like, is bringing in 1,000 tradespeople really going to be the solution to the housing crisis? Or is it just as likely that if you take all our immigration programs and it's like how a law school prof used to joke, like, I'll grade your papers by just throwing them down the stairs, and whichever ones make it the farthest get the A's. How predictable is it, especially 2, 3 generations out, what someone's contributions will be to Canada?
Well, let's just think of buy-in for a minute. Like, what are someone's reasons for wanting to come to Canada? Or what someone's, you know, is someone is a highly mobile, highly educated tech worker coming to Canada, like applying for PR in Canada, and looking for whatever program they can, whether it's PNPs or otherwise, you know. Is that person coming to Canada for the same reason that someone who has a brother and cousin and uncle all in Halifax and, you know, he's going to come and settle there? And, you know, like at the end of the day, like, you know, I think that we make assumptions. We have this belief that someone who wants to come to Canada because Canada's so great and this is where they want to be and this is where they're going to be forever. But people apply for PR to Canada and other countries for all sorts
All
of
sorts
different
of reasons,
reasons.
yeah.
And so, you know, personally, you know, I think if we could really ramp open the family class and just, you know, between family class and you know, opening up our approach to asylum seekers, there's a lot of people who want to come here for a lot of really good reasons that are like solid. And I can't help but think that it would be more beneficial to support a family in Canada by allowing them to reunite with members of their family who are away and
Yeah.
bringing them here and build up that family and that community, than bringing in a lot of single individuals
No,
who may or may
it's a
not
good
be.
point. I think
Sorry.
we're at an interesting period, actually probably the most interesting period in Canadian immigration practice, because there's all sorts of, like, it feels like we're living in an era now of the consequences, where there's huge labor shortages, there's in some areas population shortages, and others shelters for asylum claimants at capacity, with stories of people living on the street, housing shortages. The sentiments on immigration are all over the place. The current government seems to be chasing the opinion polls, and often chasing like divergent opinion polls, it seems. But there is a human component to all this, and an element of, like I mentioned, like family reunification and growing that way. It's going to be an interesting time. I'd love to have you back on. Yeah, it's been fun.
I've enjoyed the conversation. Yeah, thank you very much for the opportunity.
Yeah, I didn't get to half the questions that I had, but I do have
That's all
to
right.
run. But yeah, I'd love
Of
to
course.
definitely stay in touch, because
Feel
I
free to reach
there's
out anytime. Yeah,
yeah.
I'm definitely going to be, I'm going to continue following you. And I want to say thank you for just how much you share. Like, it's, I've just been really appreciative of the community of sharing that seems to exist amongst certainly the lawyer, immigration lawyers, and also amongst a lot of the consultants. It's just a really nice environment to operate within, and you
Yeah, I
contribute a
think
lot to
it's a
that.
very, like, it definitely seems very collegial. There are, I mean, it's like anything, there's certain actors, but for the most part, it's a very collegial bar. There's some divisions between some lawyers and consultants that I don't partake in, but I think that's even changing as well. I'm going to get some flack from some people for saying that, but I think that that's even changing as well. But
As
yeah,
the
no.
college develops and the industry, you know, keeps maturing, I think I'm hopeful that we'll see a rapprochement between the two, you know, the lawyers and the consultants,
Yeah.
especially amongst the non-immigration lawyers who would benefit from having an RCIC possibly
Oh yeah,
support
some of the
them, you
largest
know.
firms in Vancouver, some of the largest law firms in Vancouver have consultants as their who do the bulk of the immigration work and
Very
maybe
good.
refer out. Like, there's a couple firms that refer me some of the litigation or more, I don't want to say complex, but like the litigation or maybe admissibility stuff. But otherwise, like there are synergies between the two professions that complement each other very well. But otherwise, yeah,
Well,
take
hopefully,
care.
thank you very much. Hopefully, I didn't sink my RCIC career by being too open here, but I really appreciate the opportunity. This was fun. Take
Yeah,
care.
thanks.
Have a great day. Bye-bye.
Bye.